keep it? You see that one too?
Yeah, that's mine also.
Okay. That's cool.
Are you right, Gay? Good morning. You've all received a copy of the agenda. Any additions or corrections to the agenda?
We do have a couple of corrections. First, under Susan Webb, item number two, introduction of a proposed ordinance regarding the issuance of bonds. We would like to delete that item, and we'll be back at a later date. And then on number three, we would like to insert several words where it says resolution approving a written agreement for firefighting services with Indian River Volunteer Fire Company. We'd like to insert, and Mr. Griffin has reviewed this with Mr. Sammons, public hearing and resolution approving a written agreement for firefighting services. The public hearing was advertised by Mr. Sammons' office and Potter Anderson Kloon, but we just neglected to note that on the agenda.
It's advertised in the state news and the advertisement in the publisher's affidavit is present if anyone would like to see that.
That's going to be a public hearing.
But the resolution, the passage of the resolution requires the public hearing before the adoption.
Right. That will be at 11, you said, then, or whenever?
Whenever we get
whenever,
to it.
Yeah.
We get to the service?
Yeah.
Okay. I got one, too.
Okay.
Mr. Baker, in your section, number 3, 4, and 5, the discussion and possible introduction of proposed ordinances, and I apologize if it's obvious, but with the land use plan and everything else coming at us, I've kind of lost track. Have we seen these three? Have we discussed these three in public council meeting prior to?
Buffer.
We sent a copy with the council packet,
right.
But first the buffer we discussed on August 21st. We discussed a different version.
Correct.
We made changes to that version. Based on council input and some other input we received.
I guess I was probably thinking more about the lot maintenance, number 5.
I don't think we've talked about that at all.
We've talked about it at previous meetings with the constables.
In general.
Right.
It's a general conversation, right.
Right. And this was a proposal based on that meeting. And, I mean, we can...
The way it's listed, if you're not comfortable introducing, we can just discuss it.
Well, I'd almost would prefer to change the agenda to take the words possible introduction off.
Be honest with you, General, I don't ever like seeing them both together at all because it doesn't give us an opportunity just to discuss it without the pressure of after we're done, somebody quickly saying, let's introduce it. Mm-hmm. And we don't really have a time to talk about it. So I think we ought to either just... separate the two issues anyway and just always just have this plain discussion on any of them at one time.
Well, in that case, if I could move that we modify number 3, 4, and 5 to simply read discussion of a proposed ordinance. And if we come to a strong consensus today, we could go ahead and put it on for introduction next week. Is that okay?
Is that a motion?
That's a motion.
Do I have a second?
Yeah, I'll second that.
I have a motion by Mr. Phillips, second by Mr. Cole to delete the words possible introduction in the administrator's report 3, 4, and 5, discussion of those three items. It'll be discussion only today if the motion passes. Any questions on the motion? Being none, Mr. Cole?
Yes.
Mr. Phillips?
Yes.
Mr. Jones?
Yes.
Yes, motion is carried.
Could that possibly be, gentlemen, a policy in the future? We just do discussion, then we, at the end, we decide whether to put it back on for introduction. And separate this process.
Does that give anybody heartburn?
If you had discussed it on previous occasions and wanted to discuss it the same, also discuss it the same way you introduce it.
Well, you can always have discussion. I'm just saying, but putting them both together at one time, and sometimes we've never seen them. It's not good. It's not a good opportunity for. It's not good for the. I know, but the public doesn't have a chance sometimes to get this. Are you looking at me?
Yes.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Right.
Okay. Well, the public really sees it once it's advertised.
That's okay.
Okay.
idiots.
Anything else on the agenda?
No.
No, just the two changes under Mrs. Webb also.
Okay, we have the need approval of the agenda.
I make a motion we approve the agenda with the changes discussed.
Have a motion, Mr. Thorpe, seconded by? Seconded by? Mr. Rogers, to approve the agenda with the changes as we have discussed. Questions on the motion? Mr. Cole?
Yes.
Mr. Phillips?
Yes.
Mr. Rogers?
Yes.
Mr. Jones?
Yes.
Yes, motion's carried. I'd like to announce that Mr. Rogers probably has pictures of his granddaughter, if anybody's interested. I've got a whole...
That's why he's raising it.
I had a whole internet full of them so far. So he's a proud grandfather. So I congratulate him on that.
Thank you.
And the day before that, I was a proud great-grandfather, so we won't discuss ages. Approval of the minutes for August 21st. Any corrections or additions to the minutes, August 21st?
I move we approve August 21st minutes.
Second.
I have a motion, Mr. Phillips, seconded by Mr. Rogers, to approve the minutes of August 21st as presented. Mr. Cole?
Yes.
Mr. Phillips?
Yes.
Mr. Rogers?
Yes.
Yes, motion's carried. Correspondents, Mr. Griffin.
We've got several items. First, a thank you note from the Georgetown Lions Club thanking council for a donation that they will use to provide eyeglasses. A thank you note from Mrs. Sussex County, Buffy Parker, thanking you for your support. A letter from the town of Selbyville to Mr. Phillips, thanking council for generosity and assisting the town purchase needed equipment for the town's baseball field. Letter from the Delaware Safety Council, Mr. Baker, thanking council for a donation that was given to that organization and that which they would use for their safety training needs, and a certificate of membership to in that group to County Council is attached. Also a letter from the Sussex Cyclists, Inc. appears that this went to Mr. Rogers, thanking County Council for assisting them with their bicycle safety check program along Route 1 this summer. And it said that the contribution proved to be the that program proved the difference in resulting in the fewest cyclist and motorist accidents that were resulting in minimal injury to seasonal workers who ride bicycles to and from work on busy Route 1, and saying that they would like to be considered for a grant for their 2008 program. They installed 750 front and rear light sets and gave out 150 helmets and replaced faulty brakes on some bicycles. And this year they only gave the helmets to those who promised that they would wear them.
It didn't work.
Because they found that the European workers did not like to use the helmets, so they didn't want to give them to people who weren't going to use them. Any more correspondence?
Correspondence, anybody? Seeing none, Mr. Baker.
Okay, the first item of business is Salvation Army report, and with us today we have Lieutenant Debbie Engel and Lieutenant Chaz Engel from the Salvation Army in Seaford, and they have a short presentation to review and tell about their activities.
I think Sarah was going to get us turned on again.
Here's Sarah. You can do it.
Didn't put makeup on there.
Well, good morning. Thank you for inviting us this morning to share with you a little bit of what we're doing. We are Lieutenants Chaz and Debbie Engel, Salvation Army. We oversee the operations for the entire county of Sussex. We've been assigned to this county as of December last year. I think you'll be excited to what we have, to see what we have and what's been going on.
I think that what we're going to share with you this morning as well will give you an idea of just the scope of the Salvation Army internationally, nationally, in the state, and most importantly, in Sussex County as well. What we like to start with, because a lot of times people think of the Salvation Army, and of course they think about the kettles, and so what do you envision when you hear the words the Salvation Army? A lot of people think of the white trucks with the red shield, or even the thrift stores that help with clothing, or even the red kettles at Christmas time, or even sometimes the brass bands like the ones that march in the Rose Bowl Parade. But Peter Drucker of Forbes 500 actually sees us as the most effective of all organizations, both profit or nonprofit, in the United States. And a lot of that is because 83 cents of every dollar that we raise goes directly right back into our programming. There you'll see our mission statement. Our mission is to preach the gospel, but also to meet human needs in His name without discrimination. And basically what that means is when people come in for help to us, we give them help without discriminating. If they need help spiritually, we're there to help them, but the most important part is that we help them with their human needs. We were founded in 1865 by General William Booth. Booth took on the east side of London to seek his mission, and he helped both the starving spiritually and physically. We're in 115 countries, and you'll see just the languages that covers, the facilities, the disaster responses, and the total lives touched in the world. Our international leaders are General and Mrs. Shep Clifton. There's just one general. He's basically kind of the CEO of our company, but he isn't a high-paid executive or anything. He makes the same as everybody else does. In the United States, we're in all 50 states, and you'll see the communities. And most importantly, one of the things you'll see down at the bottom there are the 160 adult rehabilitation centers, of which we have one in Wilmington. We refer to them as ARCs. They're actually the centers that help the drug and alcohol addicted. It's a six-month program. And more importantly, just recently, we were awarded $3,000 from the Clean and Sober Motorcycle Gang right here in Georgetown because of one of their members whose lives was turned around and helped out an adult rehabilitation center, the Salvation Army. Our national leaders are in Alexandria, Commissioner and Mrs. Israel Gator. Of course, many of you know our canteens that are out with the disasters, and this actually is just an example of when we were out with Hurricane Katrina. Now, you can see actually at canteen this coming Sunday. Go on to the next slide. Okay, we're going to come to that a little bit later. But in Delaware itself, we have all three counties represented, 12 officers. The officers are actually ministers as well. And you can see what we've helped in terms of lodging, daycare, elderly visits, keep a job clients, and through our holiday assistance program as well. Lieutenant Chaz took that picture actually the first time down here, December 1st, coming into Sussex County, coming into the different towns of Greenwood, Seaford, and Bridgeville, at least along Route 13.
Now, don't blame me, but the sign made a difference. Your sign that came into town.
Now, right here, actually, right over behind the firehouse, we have an office here in Georgetown as well. That's Alice Brown, who lives in Seaford but works here in Georgetown, and she's our family services director here. Joyce Tell was our past family services director in Seaford. She actually is no longer working with us because of leukemia and just really bad illness right now, which is preventing her from work. This shows you just our monthly, we have a monthly food distribution program and some of the volunteers that help out with that. Our food pantry that helps people. We also help with rental assistance, electric bill relief, clothing vouchers, hook them up with temporary housing and service referrals. Of course, Christmas time is when a lot of people know us for help with stockings and toys for needy and low-income families. There you see Senator Carper helping last year in Georgetown at Walmart with our kettles. And of course, there's our canteen that helps with disaster relief. And now where you'll see us this coming Sunday, Mayor Butler, Seaford, has declared all this week in Seaford, Need Knows No Season Week. We got a proclamation last Tuesday at the city council meeting. And basically, it's to recognize that, yeah, you know us at Christmas time in helping, but really people need help all year round. And so we have a special event. We're bringing the canteen down to Walmart from 2 to 5 on Sunday afternoon. We'll have a kettle out, but we're having basically a canned food drive, a board game drive, a brass instrument drive for our program. And our supporting organizations, the Seaford High School ROTC, actually set up the whole canned food drive themselves with all the schools in Seaford. They'll be bringing canned goods over and ringing the bell at the kettle. And we'll also have help with Troops 81 and 246 who are working on their God and Church badge with us right now in brass music entertainment. Of course, we've also, that's inside our small family services building that we're hoping to bust out of sometime soon, but this was actually this past Sunday. Our church services start in March, but this past Sunday was Girl Scout Worship Sunday, and the Girl Scouts actually ran the worship service, so that's a picture of this past Sunday. Our programs right now include, of course, family services, which is the emergency crisis help, which I've already gone through, and the Christmas assistance. Of course, we have our service opportunities with Christmas kettles and our monthly food program. We also have League of Mercy. Because we are responsible for all of Sussex County, we visit nursing homes and the prison throughout all of Sussex County doing music presentations. We did a nursing home assessment when we came here, and we give special attention to even a couple of the facilities and visit them more often, places like Stokely, who don't even have the mental capacities of a two-year-old, yet it's very recognizable that music is what touches them, and they just really love to have that special attention. We also give out approximately 3,000 gifts at Christmas time to all those facilities. We just started a program called Adopt a Center at Seaford Center, which is Genesis Healthcare and Life Care at Laughlin Park, which is more frequent monthly visits to those institutions that include music, arts and crafts, game nights to the residents. Walmart's donating clothing for us to share with the residents, Bible studies, and more. We were recently named chaplains at Seaford Center. We also just started Friday Night at the Army, which is a positive influence to really get 7 to 16-year-olds, give them a place to go on Friday nights. The first Friday night of each month is for entire families. Subsequent Fridays are for the 7 to 16-year-olds, which will include a singing company, Temple Brigade, and leadership class, along with other arts activities. And just recently, Pizza King is supporting our feeding program for them on Friday nights as well, so they'll be providing pizzas every Friday night for that. We've also adopted Fred Douglas and the Early Childhood Assistance Program, which meets, it's a state-run program that meets in the Church of the Nazarene for low-income families for their kids to go to preschool, and we help them with music lessons and tennis lessons as well. The Mission of Hope, the Seaford Mission, we've started weekly song rehearsals with the men there. They actually sing at our chapel once a month, and they're actually required to attend our evening 6 p.m. Salvation meetings as part of their required curriculum. Music to Grow On started last week, similar to Kinder Music. For those of you who might know that program, it's for children ages 1.5 to 5 with their caretaker. It's music, movement, and motor skills. A lot of studies have been done connecting the ability to keep a steady beat to better literacy in students. The Girl Scout instruction, which we already spoke about, and of course summer camps, Vacation Bible School, which was also a tennis camp. And the kids also have an opportunity to attend Camp Lador, which is in the Poconos, our divisional camp as well, for music and family camps. Of course, we also have our typical chapel programs as well, which is our typical Sunday services, Bible study, and special events. We recently formed an advisory and advocacy council that support the mission of the Salvation Army. Our advisory council, our chair is Michelle Banks, an assistant manager at the Walmart in Seaford. Also on that council right now is Joe Gast with Farnell and Gast Insurance, Bev Blades and Dave Todd, who are both realtors in Seaford, John Tarbert, a lawyer, and James King, who is the manager of the Seaford Food Lion. We've also added student representatives from the Seaford High School ROTC, Katie Norman and Megan Milligan, but we're looking for county wide representation. We also would ask for people who are interested throughout Sussex County to join us as well. These people have committed on the council to a $500 a year minimum personal giving well as advocacy for their businesses. We have an advocacy council as well for those who don't have the time to come to meetings for an advisory council, but they support the mission of the Salvation Army. And the advocacy council right now includes Mayor Ed Butler, Ed Banning, Leighton Wheeler, and Glenn Roth from the Leader and State Register. So of course you can see the story of the Salvation Army that began in London in 1865 by a minister of the Vision who saw that a huge segment of society was starving both spiritually and physically. And we just hope that by what we shared today, you'll see what's going on in Sussex County and see that a lot of our programs, we don't charge for a lot of our programs, but we obviously need the support to support our expenses for being here. And we would respectfully request financial support from you at whatever level you might be able to help us with. Does anybody have any questions today?
I got one comment. Doing the Katrina thing, all the agencies out there, including yourself, nationally, you were the only one that asked the public for permission to restock your food pantries and said that every single dime collected went to the cause and there were no administration fees. Mm-hmm. All the rest of them had up to 38% to 40% administrative and salaries for upper level people, but the Salvation Army prided himself on just, they asked for permission from the public.
That's right.
And I thought that was a neat deal.
That's right.
And actually, Delaware, at the time we put this together, had donated $789,000 towards Katrina, which all of that went down there.
Right.
And at last count, we're still serving meals, but at last count, we're at $15 million.
But those of us who work on the Salvation Army, I mean, we're here 24/7. We don't get huge salaries, but the Salvation Army gives us what we need to just take care of our lives so that we can devote our work to the people that need us.
Absolutely. Good job.
Thank you. Thank you for the opportunity today. We appreciate it.
Thanks, Debbie. We appreciate it. Glad to have you in Sussex County. And do we have them, are they in our human service grants?
I don't think they were. But that would be a good opportunity.
Okay.
The timing is perfect. If you could send me a letter.
Okay.
Bev, and
okay.
My attention.
Okay.
We'll see how the budget comes out and
all
see
right.
If we maybe possibly a human service grant.
That would be great.
Yeah.
Thank you so much.
I think that would be the correct category.
Okay.
Okay.
Yeah. Thanks for coming. We appreciate what you're doing.
Thanks.
For everybody here in Sussex County.
Thank you. And please feel free to get in touch with us if you have any more questions.
Okay.
Mr. Baker. The next item we have is Mr. Mark Isaacs from the University of Delaware is here today. We're representing the Ag Extension Program that the university offers, and Mark can explain about a little bit of services they provide, and I know the county annually contributes to the program, and we have a check for you also.
Thank you, Mr. Baker. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. It's a great opportunity to thank you for all the support that you've given, not only this year, but annually. On behalf of the University of Delaware College of Agriculture and Natural Resources, I'm going to take this opportunity to thank you. And the unique thing that the council support does for us in Sussex is it allows the university to tailor programs that are specifically needed by our agricultural producers, our public service entities, our youth, and the monies that you provide. One question that always comes out is, does it stay in Sussex County? Well, every dollar stays in Sussex County. Nothing goes forward up to the main campus. This year, you're providing $118,098 that supports our extension program, and that's basically all of the program areas that roll into our 4-H youth development, family and consumer sciences, public policy and economic development, and our ag production, as well as our safety programs. And that's one thing that I want to highlight, spend a few minutes on doing that. Also, the money supports our poultry research and our field crop research program. We do get monies from private companies to conduct research and extension programs, but they're often targeted based on the source of funds. So it doesn't give you the flexibility to kind of tailor meet some of the needs of our county residents. And then last, but certainly not least, is the support that you've provided for Lasher Laboratory, which, as you know, is world-renowned for poultry disease diagnostics, has been doing some unbelievable things across not only in Delaware and the Delmarva Peninsula, but worldwide. And the contributions that you provide allow us to continue to strengthen those programs as well. I'd like to take a few minutes to, you know, one thing that you did last year and you're doing again this year is supporting our safety program, our extension safety program, and that's something that's really near and dear to our heart. Many of you know Mr. Ron Jester, who retired from the university as our extension safety specialist. His position has been filled by Mr. Mike Leff, and this year the county's providing $20,000. The thing that I want to point out is this is a partnership between the state and the county. Three-quarters of the funds supporting Mike's safety agent position comes from the state, and the county is providing a quarter. So, again, it's an opportunity to show the partnership where the county is working with the state on improving the lives of our residents here in Sussex County. So I'd like to ask Mike to come up and just give you a brief synopsis of where he thinks our extension safety program is going to come. Mike.
Good morning. I too want to echo Mark's thanks for your support of all the extension programs, but in particular this new change with the safety program. I will be replacing Ron Jester, and that's neat, it's exciting, and I'm proud to do that as well. But it's also to be able to take it in some different directions. My primary focus has always been traffic safety with the university through grant funding through federal and state agencies. Now we're going to, and that's been focused in Kent and Sussex County, we're going to continue that and actually expand that some with the as a replacement for myself. What we're going to be able to jump into some more, though, is some more of the workplace safety, things where we're hitting not just the bigger businesses, but actually seeing what the smaller businesses and companies and organizations might be interested in, what can we can do to help them. Some things coming with disaster management, and certainly with state and local and county agencies that do that now, as well as all the fire departments and whatnot. We'd like to help with the ag producers and actually the families that are needing help when there's a disaster. We talk about a major disaster, certainly you guys mentioned Katrina, but think about flooding in, you know, western Sussex County or wherever it might be. There's a family that has its own disaster, and we'd like to whip through our own current network of agents and youth and 4-H to extend our reach out to them as well. And then, of course, we'd like to work on the multicultural outreach and continue our efforts towards childhood injury prevention and actually grow that some more. So thanks an awful lot for your support. If there's anything we can ever do or if there's something that your constituents need help with, certainly feel free to let us know that. We'd be glad to jump in and help.
And thanks, Council, just so you all are aware, Ron's position was pretty much fully funded from federal grants, which, as you know, grant programs oftentimes stipulate, you know, certain benchmarks and certain program areas that you can work on. And Ron did a fabulous job and did some wonderful things, but by basically redefining the position with support from the council as well as support from the state, we're able to really target Sussex County, and that's the thing that we're really proud about and look forward to working in partnership with you all as well. And as Mike echoed, you know, as you know, you're dealing with your constituents, if you see things that you think that we can be more involved in or strengthen our programs, please don't hesitate to let us know. And we certainly appreciate all the support that you've given and look forward to continuing the relationship.
Are you going to bring the farm safety program back around? Used to do rescue?
That's still going to be a part. Yeah. Yes, the farm safety still, we're not losing anything. Actually, what we're doing is we're expanding. Okay, so.
Mark, I appreciate everything you've been doing. I had been wanting to mention publicly a desire to see a greater emphasis placed on irrigation. Of course, in this drought year, everyone is talking about it. But I was surprised to find out, according to the Delaware Agriculture Statistician, that only 22% of our crop land is irrigated in the state of Delaware. And I think that offers a tremendous opportunity if we can do the proper research and development of irrigation systems that could somehow irrigate a significant percentage of that remaining 78%.
Well, I'm glad you bring that up, Councilman Phillips, because we do have on staff now an extension ag engineer who is focusing on irrigation management. The other thing to add to that piece is, as you know, nationally, the whole conservation piece of it. And there's federal funds available for what they call EQIP programs that strengthen management of water quality and water resources. But you're exactly right. And we've got someone on staff now that we're gonna try to ramp that program up. And there's a lot of, also in the irrigation sector as well, you know, a lot of times you get into bidding wars, the producers do, and trying to get, you know, an irrigation system for the cheapest amount of money they can. Oftentimes, there's an educational component that's missing in that. and, you know, what's the most efficient sprinkler packages, you know, or can you, is the raw in the engine system over-designed, over-engineered, so that's where we can come into play on the education piece of it.
I can appreciate that, and also the management. I know a lot of the EQIP programs are designed for water conservation, but very little has been done in the recent past to develop means of irrigating new lands, and I think that's very important. I think you need to look at ways that you can do it in a in an economical and in a conserving way. But as long as we're just going to be satisfied with managing 22% of our cropland as irrigated, we're not going to be able to produce the amount of corn necessary to support the broiler industry. We're going to leave tremendous amounts of nutrients in the fields this year. Those fields that were drought stricken are probably going to leave more than half of the nutrients in the field that are going to potentially leach into the soil or run off into the waterways. And it's those dry land pieces of ground that are the target for development. I mean, a farmer has a right to sell his land, and if he's going to choose, it's going to be those dry land pieces that are sold off as lots first.
Right.
I think we've done a good job irrigating the center pivots, but you've got to have a pretty decent sized field, and it has to be relatively square. There's a lot of misshapen smaller fields that need some type of irrigation system that's economical. And I wish you would focus some efforts on developing those.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Okay. John, we got any other questions or comments for? I'll come down right quick. Get
a photo on
Mike. Photo on.
My big check.
Vance, George, come on.
Oh.
What's so big? Not a picture. Got a jacket on to come down here.
Hmm?
Got a jacket.
I can't afford one.
That's great.
I guess if I've got a camera, come down right. We're going to
Come on, Chick, with you. Drop the bomb.
For coming on the back of the year, you better get those candles out.
Thank God for digital cameras.
I can't.
I said, thank God for digital cameras. Thank you. Thanks, George.
You're welcome. You're welcome.
Let me pass these out.
Okay, the next item on the agenda is a discussion of a revised forested buffer ordinance, and we did discuss a different version of this ordinance at the August 21st meeting, and we have made some changes reflecting some of the council's comments and some other comments that we received. So just to again highlight some of the provisions here. The intent of the ordinance is to clarify that the forested buffers would be required on every boundary of a subdivision that's adjacent to lands used for ag purposes, and not just the boundary between the new subdivision and residential lot, the new residential lots and the ag land. And on the second page, there's a definition provided, and the underlined section here reflects the additional verbiage that's added to the existing ordinance. Forested indoor landscape buffer strip is defined as a strip of land not less than 30 feet in width, exclusive of any residential lots, exclusive of stormwater management areas or facilities, exclusive of open space, recreational amenities, wastewater treatment facilities, water treatment facilities, streets, buildings, or other service improvements. And it is around the entire outer perimeter of any portion of a major subdivision that is immediately adjacent to lands primarily used for ag purposes. And as you can see, the changes is adding stormwater management areas and some of the other recreational amenities, et cetera. With this proposal, the forested buffer would be designed and certified by a licensed Delaware landscape architect, again reviewed by the state forester and subject to final review and approval by the Planning Zoning Commission. The conditions that apply to the forested buffer would be trees to be planted would include a mix of 70% deciduous shade trees and 30% evergreen. The deciduous trees would have a minimum caliber or width of 1.5 inches and a minimum height of 6 feet. The evergreen trees would have a minimum height of 5 feet. The landscape plan may include suitable existing trees of common local species, provided they achieve the overall goal of the plan, which is defined in Section E. And basically, the goal of the plan is that the trees would be planted in a staggered natural manner and which would filter views from and into the subdivision. As far as how the trees are planted, requirement that the buffer area would include a minimum of 4 inches of topsoil and grass or substitute wood chips for the grass. The buffer would be installed within 18 months from the date site work is authorized to commence. The developer would be responsible for maintenance of the buffer area for a minimum of 2 years or until a later date when it's transferred over to the Homeowners Association. The Homeowners Association would be responsible for the perpetual maintenance of the buffer, the trees and whatnot, and would be responsible for replanting trees that die and would maintain the area according to best management practices. In Section D, there is two exceptions on the buffer, and that is would not be required where there's a road within that buffer area or where there's a stormwater outfall. And the final plat plan would be approved by the Conservation District. And on the bond section, again, the bonds we cover would include forested buffer strips as well as other amenities. And the when approving a conditional use or a change of zone, the council will have the right to impose a condition requiring the applicant to install a forested or landscape buffer as defined in this ordinance. So that
means this becomes the definition for other ordinances and other parts of our code.
Well, this section 115-18 was put in. I believe maybe it was Mr. Phillips who said that in addition to expanding more clearly defining what a forested buffer is and what may and may not be in it, I believe his comment was, well, is it possible to come up with a means of requiring a forested buffer in other situations, such as an RPC or a conditional use where you're approving those where it wouldn't ordinarily apply. So this section of the ordinance would apply to all districts within our code. So you could,
but it's not automatic. RPC and a CU.
It's not automatic. You could put it on as a condition.
I'm just wondering why not. And now, David, is this ordinance now just pertains to the AR district or MR district? And
it pertains to major subdivisions.
Well, no matter what
the area of major subdivisions that are adjacent to agricultural land.
No matter what the district.
Right.
So throughout the whole county. Okay.
But this 115-18 is saying you could insert it whether it's adjacent to agricultural land or not.
Right. This basically defines what a buffer is now.
Right.
The clarification, the only concern is when it says lands primarily used for agricultural purposes. Is that anybody have that definition, right? Because you have to go to what this other
AR.
As defined in Chapter 115, Article
such. I believe Shane may be able to tell you, but it talks about those 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 talk about the number of different types of animals.
Just clear that up. What does that mean? Because I can see us now, having a debate whether it's is it primarily used or secondarily used?
It would reference poultry operations, cattle, sheep, goats, crops.
Trees?
If a tree farm has a management plan through the state
forest. But if it's just a large tract of trees, that wouldn't be considered?
No, if they got to have a conservation management plan through the state, like Chesapeake Pulpwood Company.
Right.
That would be considered agricultural use.
Horses? So like on section page 2F, the last sentence says best practices in the forestry industry. That allows timbering? It don't allow timbering in this area, does it?
Because the farmer could do. I've seen woods knocked down and become agriculture in use. Mm-hmm. I saw Melvin Joseph knock down hundreds of acres of land that were all treed and thickly wooded and became agriculture, because, and then with the price of corn going up, I think you'll see more farmers knocking down some trees. So I'm just saying, you got to have an ordinance that is able to be a little flexible, just because today it's trees and there's not some kind of organized tree plan or something on it, there's no buffer. But then next thing you know, the guy's in there, in a couple of years, seeing it's economical or it cuts it over, and then
right.
So I just think it ought to be
allowed to do that,
huh?
I mean,
well, no, I'm just saying the 30-foot buffer ought to just be. I just think it ought to be required.
Yeah.
For what, everything?
Again, yeah. I just think it, because we're permitting the developer to get the density. We're giving him the density. He's not losing anything.
That's right. I don't know what you're talking about.
I know, but I'm just saying there's a couple issues I think that would lend itself to just say we ought to just say that there's a 30-foot buffer, because it provides for wildlife corridor, it provides for privacy, it provides for a lot of other things. Anyway.
I think it does say that, as long as it's agriculture.
But a stand of trees would not require any kind of buffer. If a guy had 100 acres of a stand of trees, there's no buffer required. What I just, when Vance said, well, why would you want to do that? It's because I have seen many of these stands of trees become fields.
Right.
Within a couple of years.
Which is correct.
But then you can't come back and create this 30-foot buffer.
Right, and these stand trees. But you're saying if he takes the trees down and makes it agricultural for farming, you've got a little buffer around his...
No. I'm saying we ought to just automatically, when somebody goes into the agricultural district and creates a major subdivision, whatever this is...
That's not what you're talking. You're talking farmer.
He's saying there's a little loophole in this definition of ag property. He believes that it doesn't necessarily need a plan, a tree farm plan, in his opinion, to qualify for having a buffer applied to the adjacent development. So I can't say that I agree, but that's what he's trying to...
Right, he gets it. The rest of you don't.
No, I understand.
Now, I'm just saying, I think in the agricultural district, or in other words, what we've been doing a number of things here, Finley, we've allowed everybody to cluster to provide a lot of open space. We've also heard about these guys getting up here about the wildlife corridors and everything else. If you just said a 30-foot buffer is required, not only if it's adjacent to lands used primarily for agricultural purposes, says, because there might be some vacant, like I said, 100 acres out there that could be converted in the future, but then the development's there. And then the conversion comes down to agriculture, and there's no buffer.
Are you talking
and you don't want to put the buffer on the farm.
Are you talking about maybe including tracts of marketable timber?
Yeah. In my opinion, that's...
Or maybe the way to do it would be to include that as an agricultural purpose.
So then maybe, right now, it isn't under our county, whatever. If that's part of the code, I don't know. Is that part of the code, that list you just read, Shane?
Tree farming, too.
But a tree farm has to have some kind of
management
program.
Yes.
I'm not saying getting tree farms or actually getting
some. I know that. I'm just saying there's many stands of trees out there that have nothing.
How about along the roadway?
Buffer from the roadway?
Yeah.
I wouldn't mind that, because I hate to look at the back of everybody's house as I see these new developments. A lot of subdivisions, a lot of jurisdictions have addressed that. But I'm just saying, gentlemen, it might be better, or to consider, because we're discussing it, to require a 30-foot buffer around these subdivisions, because they already can cluster, they're providing open space, and this will be part of their open space program. They also get the density from it. And then if another, the next section of ground, the adjoining parcels of ground become developments, so then they would have to provide also 30 feet, so we'd have like 60-foot corridors that would link a lot of this stuff, which would provide these wildlife corridors.
Have 30 feet on each side.
You could have the potential of have 30 feet on each side if it ever gets converted, which would be an asset to the county and would be something for the wildlife.
We talked about this in the beginning. If you were first one in, for lack of better words,
right, you'd have to do it, and the next guy wouldn't. This would say everybody would have to be bear the burden of providing open space and wildlife corridors, but they're still getting their density. Developers are getting these smaller lots, so it doesn't really affect, I think, their overall planning. They just said have to incorporate, and these things then could be connected, and you could use them around stream beds, you could do around tax ditches, and a lot of this stuff would...
With all due respect, that wasn't put in, because that wasn't part of what we were told to put in.
I understand that. I'm just saying, it was mentioned, but it never got put in. And again, I just think if we required 30-foot buffers on every subdivision, it would make a fair playing field. Everybody would be affected the same, and then you'd have all these advantages to go with it.
30 feet ain't nothing.
And the developers, I can't imagine that they're going to have to provide open space anyway, and they're getting all this other stuff. So I think it's a win-win, but it's just up for discussion. I don't know if anybody has any comments about it, but that way, depending, like you just said, the first guy in doesn't get slammed on the next guy.
Hey, it's written right here, the first guy had a disadvantage versus...
I'm just saying, this should be required.
Correct.
Not only if it's adjacent to...
Well, I think like Mr. Griffith said, the ordinance would have to be rewritten or amended.
Now's the time. I don't know if it needs to be
introduced yet.
No. Finley, now's the time to do it. That's why we're having... I think that's why it's nice to have a good discussion and then move forward on it. But
not that next to a commercial tentative.
I think a 30-foot buffer should be, when it's residential next to commercial, I think 100% yes, we ought to have a nice buffer. It might even should be more, but there should definitely be buffers between residential and commercial. Should be automatic.
Are we required to have a buffer now? I know C1 is like a 5-foot setback or something like that.
If a commercial project comes in next to a subdivision, they've got to screen their parking areas.
That's about it. There's no 30-foot buffers, no buffer required. Now, what I'm trying to say is the buffer should be required, and it would just make for a better future for the county, especially in the rural areas where people are used to open space and this and that. These buffers would provide a lot of advantages, and one of them would be like wildlife corridors, which we hear about all the time.
30 feet's not a lot.
No, 30 feet's nothing. So if you had 30 and 30, you'd have basically the top of a road, which isn't a whole lot. But the developers still get everything they want. It hadn't affected their density. Their open space is part of this 30%. It just plays into it all, and it gives them, I think, a nice break. And I'll guarantee you, the developers will get more money for a lot that backs up to 30 to 60 feet of woodland. Oh, and they will. It'll become an economic advantage to them, like the way they put lots on these stormwater retention ponds, and then all of a sudden they got lakefront.
Of course, we have
stormwater retention front, but lakefront.
That's right.
Lakefront.
I think that depends on what the buffer looks like. I mean, you can get scraggle a bunch of trees in there, and I don't know we've
covered that with this. This says it has to still be approved by all those people. I'm just saying it's whatever we've done in here. If this is good,
well, 10 years down the road, the trees die and bagworms set in, it kills all the mess. That's going to look nice backed up to a subdivision or a commercial.
Well, there'll be an economic incentive to maintain these. They're part of these people's backyards. They're not going to let this happen. And I've seen a lot of woodland that's been able to survive a bagworm or some droughts and stuff like that. You can talk about all the negative, but I'm just saying
they don't own it. Who owns it?
It would be part of the homeowner association. It would be part of their project where they live. Their community. It's just what everything... The only thing I'd change in this was that it would be required not just adjacent to lands are primarily used for agricultural purposes.
Kind of along those lines with a perpetual maintenance requirement. Who is going to kind of oversee that? Will it be tree lease?
Homeowners Association.
So
they're required to use best management practices in the forestry industry to maintain it.
Is there any governing agency that...
But if somebody complains, are we out busting? Do we have a tree specialist on?
It would be planning.
You don't want to be out.
I mean, you would have to go out.
But they require...
They have to definitely know that.
No, I don't think we ever, even this ordinance, are going to go out and pay inspectors. If there's a dead tree out there, Finley, that one of our inspectors are going to go, well, there's a dead tree, you got to replace it. I mean, you're getting now a little far-fetched on the intent and what county, how county government operates. I've never seen that in any of our ordinances, but I'm just saying, if this ordinance is good, the only change I would make is just say it would be required. Everything else would be the enforcement, the responsibilities, the type of trees, the bearers, whatever, it's all linear. Don't change any of that.
Everybody's on it.
And if some of the good developers, they put them in anyway, plus a berm now. It's the ones you're protecting, the ones that come back.
So there's no requirement for berms, I'm just saying we're giving some space there, and there's a lot of positive things about it.
I don't think you should have a berm in the 30 feet, just go...
No, I don't...
I'm just saying, there's some people now that already do that.
Let's run the cost up.
Run the cost up, man. How's that run the cost up? So tell me that.
Typical what we do, George, when we do something, we do an overkill.
Wait, how do you run the cost up? You're putting it, I just said you're imposing 30 feet on a developer.
Just leave it.
I'm just saying you impose the 30 feet on every developer. Now, how do you raise the cost? Because it's lands they don't have to tamper with. A lot of times it's wooded, and they just leave it wooded.
Is there a provision in there for them to leave what they have, even if it doesn't...
Yeah, that's a good point.
Right down to 60%.
So in the top of page 3, the landscape plan may include suitable existing deciduous and evergreen trees of common local species, provided they achieve the overall goal of the plan to filter the views, and provided the existing trees survive the site work construction activity and any changes in the water table and exposure which may result from construction activity occurring prior to the date the buffer plans are required to be installed, as provided in subsection F.
Okay,
thank you.
Just a thought, I don't know, anybody find anything positive about those comments? It's not overkill, Dale. It's everything just in this ordinance. It just requires it on everybody. And I think it would make a better county and better everything.
Jim, I got one thing. You just read about the 18 months and it says authorized. Is that like if stormwater management gives them the okay to go ahead and start doing site plan? As soon as that drops, Jane, that's when the 18 months starts clicking? Is that... Defined
from the date site work is authorized to commence, yes.
Okay, so we have whether soil conservation, which is usually the...
That would be after the county issues a letter of notice to proceed.
Okay, so it would be our date.
That notice to proceed letters, what triggers this 18?
Okay.
Start running.
That's cool.
Jim, if we... I think, Mr. Rogers, are you sympathetic to some of my concerns?
Oh, yeah.
And I think Vance just walked out. I don't know what he thinks, but anybody else? I was just going to say, if we put it in, we could take it out.
Absolutely.
So if we added in that it would be automatic for all subdivisions, Jim, would it be possible then just to restrict it to the site being developed and so fall back to this definition, maybe just change, tweak the definition of agriculture or something, and add... Existing standards.
That's a whole other ordinance, if I'm not mistaken.
No. We can
get it now, but you can't. You have to take it out of a public hearing if you want to take it out.
Well, I suppose we need to give us some idea of where you want to go. If you want to make it apply to every major subdivision on every boundary, with the exception of where there may be a collector street or an outfall.
Whatever the exemptions are in here, yeah, just follow this.
No matter what is next door to that subdivision, that's pretty clear. If you want to have us just amend the definition of agricultural purposes to include standing marketable timber, we could certainly do that. In that instance, then it would just be adjacent to the, that would be saying those are additional agricultural purposes.
That
wouldn't be as large an amendment.
Right, well, it wouldn't also change this. What I'm just saying, my suggestion is that we actually change it for all parcels. So if we put in the change for all parcels, could we then back up to what this ordinance says without having to go through is that a substantial change or is that not?
You could do that.
Okay. So then, gentlemen, is there a consensus that we could add that in at this point, and he makes that change?
Of course, now, when an earlier version of this got some distribution and publicity, we've already started getting letters from developers saying even this is...
Well, there's no time. I don't know if time is of the essence with this. We're going through the whole land use process, so...
They were already saying that not allowing walking trails into buffers overkill, that requiring them to do it within 18 months is too quick. So,
but we can still add those comments into it.
You have it on every subdivision everywhere. You're going to get a lot more feedback from developers, I think.
That's okay. That's what they call public hearings.
Yeah. So is there consensus to put it in, Finley?
Let him debate it.
I mean, we can debate it. I'll certainly...
Well, I mean, to bring it back to try to get it rewritten at this point.
I understand,
point.
Yeah.
We have it now or we don't do it.
Right. I mean, if you want to...
Is that yes or no?
Certainly, that's why we got public hearings, and we'll certainly hear whether we can do it and take it out or leave it in.
You're saying yes?
Yeah. Yeah, we can.
Yes.
Dale, you got three. The consensus is okay.
Doesn't matter when I...
I think they got three, so...
Let's just move it.
Go ahead and put it in.
Keep it moving.
We debated at the public hearing.
Right?
Put what in?
Bite this one later.
Whatever you all put in, Mr. Remember? It would affect, Jim, it would affect all major subdivisions.
And all that.
And all ground.
Right.
Including roadway. You know, this whole ordinance...
No,
Jim.
That's what they said.
I think they'll put it around all single-family lots in the county.
Yeah.
And all boundaries, including...
And all boundaries in the county. Everything is...
Make the change in this ordinance where it affects, you know, the boundaries, and just make it for all major subdivisions, and then everything else that's in here, just leave it.
That will say around the entire perimeter.
Sure. Around the entire perimeter.
Well, then this exempt the roadways?
No,
except a collector street or
whatever this was. Okay. It's a simple chain.
I don't want to see any vinyl.
Nothing's a simple chain when you're drafting roads.
That's the procedure shaker.
He's working for the developer manager.
Okay, Mr. Baker, let's go to the next one. We've done a good job on this one.
Okay. So we'll make that change and we'll be back.
We won't be back next week.
No, okay.
Take your time. We're off next week.
Can think of a nice time job last week.
It's job security.
Full time, Jim.
Is that what it is?
I don't think so.
Oh, we got to get rid of it. Get in this system.
Might get Hal to come down and help me.
The next one, this ordinance is regarding the clean hands policy, and this one was revised for discussion today, and it requires applicants for building permits, zoning changes, et cetera, to be current in the payment of obligations to the county, such as taxes, sewer, and water charges. We have made software changes, programming changes, so that the proposed ordinance can be implemented if you so choose. At the counter, at the building permit counter, we now have, the staff there now has the ability to determine whether or not someone is delinquent in their property taxes and sewer and water charges. As far as the ordinance itself, the county obligations, which must be current, we have a list which would include property taxes, capitation taxes, water and sewer charges, application fees, permit fees, and then any interest or related court costs associated with any of the above. The issuance of the county approvals for building permits, mobile home placement permits, building code, rezonings, conditional uses, et cetera, would be dependent upon the payment of county obligations if they're not delinquent. If a party is requesting county approval, but not all obligations, but they have delinquent obligations on, say, another property, then the county could still deny the application. So that's in 116-3. And as for 116-4C, failure by the appropriate administrative agency or official to issue such written denial would enable the applicant to receive the permit. So we would require a written denial if this went into effect. An appeal could be made to the county administrator within 20 calendar days of a denial, and then the applicant would be permitted to provide proof of payment or that an error was made or that the denial is based on incorrect information or is just plain not appropriate for that situation. So
so you would be the appeal process, the county administrator, that person, and in,
yeah, individual. I mean, we could, so at least we could have a second appeal if you would like to go to the council.
No, I do.
So the synopsis is, if they're behind on their taxes, their water, sewer, whatever, when you come in, we will not issue them permits until that's current.
So that's current.
Any other questions?
They have to be delinquent.
Comments? No. Okay.
Yeah, I got one, Bill. Is there any reason why zoning violations shouldn't be part of this? We have many people that have zoning violations outstanding, and we're not, you know, we're having a hard time getting their attention.
That's not really money owed to us.
It would be included if there is a fine or something that hasn't been paid.
Or should that be? Should that then? I mean, somebody could say, "Hey, I got a zoning violation, and my fine is associated with a zoning violation. It's not in your list." So
because it's not a monetary obligation.
Right. Yeah.
What's that?
It's not there because it's not a monetary obligation.
But you just said they may be, they may not have.
If there's been a fine already assessed, I mean, if they've taken somebody to JP court and the court has ordered them to pay X number of dollars, they're going to have to pay that before they get another permit or an approval.
Right. And where would that be? Six, number six, or what? Which of these?
I don't know how
it says we got
interest, penalties, court costs, and or attorney fees.
But wouldn't it be construed that it would only be of this
applicable to those first five?
That's right. Now, zoning issues aren't listed anywhere. Should they?
We didn't make them, but if that's something that...
But I'm just saying, is this something that should be? I mean,
no, it should not be.
Why not?
Because it's not a fine that's being assessed. If they're assessed a fine, the other county... money, then yes. But if this county has violated them because they need to be another zoning classification, what they are, that's not something to hold up a building permit for.
Maybe we could ask Mr. Abbott if he has any thoughts on whether zoning violations generally, where you issue a citation of some type for somebody or send a letter asking somebody to rectify a condition, should that be a reason for withholding some approval on another issue, on another request?
Well, the only way there won't be fined any money is, if, like you said, if it goes to JP court. Most of the zoning applications that you get, the conditional uses are the result of a violation. The inspectors issue the violation, people come in and start the process through DLDOT.
It would close off a means for them to correct a violation. And another concern I would have about somebody who's violated the setback provision, that's not going to show up on a computer screen that's going to tell somebody they're in violation.
And if we go to court, and I guess Eddie's here with the constables, but we don't have any record. We don't keep records if the judge, which is usually out of our hands, finds them, and then have any feedback from the judicial system unless they bring it back herself to put it in the computer.
That should be done if the court imposes a penalty.
I got a simple question. If I had a zoning violation against me, for instance, I'm doing something, I'm running a business or something, okay, and I come in and get a building permit, and I've been cited for a zoning violation. Would you issue a building permit to a gentleman, even though there was a zoning violation? I mean, he had a...
Right now they do, yeah.
Yeah, they do. That's what I'm saying. So allow that?
You can allow that, because if you're by right, you're allowed to do certain things, even though you might be illegal running that business. By right, you're allowed to put a shed up or those kind of things.
Along the same logic, if you got people here that are, you know, in arrears on some of these other things, why would you issue somebody a building permit who's got a like it currently got a zoning violation.
What you called him up there for to ask a question? Do you have a lot of people asking for building permits that got a zoning violation? You said yes.
It's a lot of them.
It's a lot of them.
And it's like,
is that why you ask you?
Yeah, I mean, so what don't you like about that answer?
That's not recorded money that they owe the county. I thought that's what we were after, trying to get them current.
Right.
You're supposed to keep your house in order before you keep violating.
If you wanted to be a more encompassing, broader type of ordinance, we could certainly add that in, but...
What we have multiple operations, and maybe this one segment of the operation has somehow run, afoul of the code. They've come in, they've applied for a conditional use. It's going to be 18 months before they're even heard. Are you suggesting that we hold up all these other potential operations from getting a permit because they made a mistake over here? I think that's a little too punitive.
Are you talking about a violation of the zoning ordinance, which we didn't address, or talking about these that are just...
These could be taken care of just by writing a check. Do that. Or you go to Mr. Baker if you have a problem with it and work something out.
We'd have to almost include some exception for the person who's made application to give them an opportunity to make an application to correct the problem.
Yeah, if after the public hearing is that their zoning violation is, or conditional use is denied, then they don't rectify it, then there may be some need for punishment. You don't agree?
No, I just don't think the
issue.
We have a lot of people who skirt our zoning regulations because they know there's no enforcement, there's no punitive damage or anything that brings them into compliance. And I think that we ought to be bringing them into this kind of ordinance, this clean hand ordinance, too. Also, that you ought to be in compliance with county ordinance before you get any building permits, get anything.
But there are some.
You ought to be.
There are some innocent mistakes.
There's always going to be some innocent mistakes, but I'm just saying that everybody, when you're in a zoning violation, you've broken one of our county ordinances, which is law. So you basically have violated county law. So I don't know. I just think
you I come in, I'm not paying my county taxes, but and I've been cited last week by an inspector for a zoning violation, but I'm coming in tomorrow for a building permit. How's that going to show up? You going to have proof that my zoning, there's a zoning violation against me?
Someone would have to go to each inspector's desk, and there's a booklet.
Well, it can be put onto a computer. Don't we have computers?
Some subdivision violations are put on a computer. I don't know. I'm sure we could do zoning.
Change your
plans. There may be some programming, computer programming issues that would need to be looked into before you had me.
I think it spans. That's carrying it way too far.
I mean, you could certainly go with this ordinance as it's proposed, and if you later decide to amend it to make it more all-encompassing, you could.
I'm going
to
get.
If they owe us money, I think this is fine. But I think carrying it further, in my opinion, we're one overkill again. Just like last one.
Well, we do have a mechanism if somebody is violated to come in and take care of it, or they go to court. That's pretty much it. Is that right, Eddie? That's the name of the constable's move? I mean, after it goes through planning, Jenny?
Okay, is there any consensus to include zoning in this ordinance, or leave it like it is?
I would say yes. Just want you to, anybody else want to
Mr. Phillips,
address it?
You want to leave it in, or leave zoning in, or leave it out?
Leave it out.
Mr. Rogers?
I think I'll be discussed. Leave it in.
Out. Mr. Jones?
Out.
Out. Okay, take it like it is. Mr. Baker, next week,
could we put this on the agenda for next week? Or a couple
of hours? That's new.
Introduction only.
Okay.
Yep, no discussion.
We got one more. Okay, one more.
Yeah.
This is an ordinance regarding lot maintenance. And I'm passing out a copy here now. This would revise lot maintenance regulations and penalties, as we have had some discussion regarding this, and Alan Holloway, our chief constable, Eddie Parker, director of assessment, Shane Abbott are all here. It pertains to parking, of storing, maintenance of vehicles and boats, prohibited growth and accumulations on non-agriculture lands, and then waste materials outside commercial premises. And the first part of the ordinance, this ordinance as drafted here, would amend Chapter 80 of the code, which basically the lot maintenance is part of that transfer station division portion of the code, which of course we do not have a transfer station division now. So pages 2 and 3 is basically deleting that portion of the code. And then starting on page 4 is when we really get into the proposed new ordinance. And some of this we are currently doing.
So this 80-1, 80-2, the 80s dashes.
All the 80s are coming out.
All the 80s are going out.
Because we don't have that ability to enforce that through the transfer station division.
All right.
Okay. So on page 4, at the top of page 4, we start with parking, storing, and maintaining of vehicles and trailers. And on lands which are zoned and used for owner-occupied single-family purposes, this would apply. And section B there says that no more than 2 vehicles and or 2 boats or other watercraft, which are either inoperable, dismantled, wrecked, unlicensed, etc., would be allowed on a residential property. And that is a little bit, that is the amount that they're allowed now.
Other than an enclosed building.
Other than an enclosed building, correct.
Well,
and then section C notes that if there is more than one lot, but actually, it doesn't, well, we have situations where there's more than one lot, but no vehicle, boat, or other watercraft would be situated on any residentially zoned property that is vacant and not improved with a dwelling. So that is different from what we have now, and it attempts to address some of the problems.
The code does say that now.
Okay, question though, if you have I for instance, had a piece of property, it was 2 lots, but it was only 1 parcel.
If it's combined parcel, then you can have the 2 vehicles, boats.
Spread all over everything.
So you could have 4 vehicles, Mr. Cole.
Now, if it's combined as 1 parcel, that would be treated as 1 lot.
Okay.
Okay, so you could have stuff, you could have your stuff parked on that other vacant lot.
If it's part of the same
as
lot.
1 parcel. Now, is that clear in here? Is that
yes.
Distinction? Okay. Because that's the only thing, because I know a lot of people have a couple lots, but it's taxed as 1 parcel.
As far as enforcement, it would be the duty of planning zoning director or his designee, which would include the county constables, to enforce the ordinance, and the constables would, at this time, would be the enforcement agency. We would require a statement of, we would provide a statement of required corrective action to occur in less than 30 days, and that could be extended for a period of up to 6 months by the county staff. The notice would have to be delivered, the violation notice would have to be delivered personally or sent by certified or first class mail, or if that notice is returned, it would have to be posted on the property. Fines, penalties, if the property owner was guilty of a misdemeanor upon conviction, the fine would be between $250 and $500 for the first conviction, between $500 and $750, second, $750 or $1,000 for the third, and not less than $2,500 for the fourth. And then there's the penalty if the defendant continues to, there's a conditional fine if the defendant continues to violate and not correct the problem. This would all go through JP court. There are some exemptions. Antique cars or and whatnot that's stored in a building would be an exemption. A dwelling which is located, which is part of and located on a larger tract of land primarily used for bona fide agriculture purposes would be exempt. And then vehicles, boats, or other watercraft which are not required to be licensed or registered would be exempt. And then that covers the vehicle and boat section. The next section, 115-191D, is regarding prohibited growths and accumulations, overgrowth of grasses and weeds, and then accumulation of rubbish and trash and whatnot. As far as grass, it would be a maximum height of 12 inches, and there's some other information there about that. Waste material would be, does not include materials accumulated in orderly fashion for such as firewood, compost piles, building materials in good condition, etc. What would happen with this in terms of enforcement, within 10 days after notice by the county on one of these items, the director could actually have the, we could have the removal done by a third party, and then we would charge, send a bill to the property owner. And then section 191F is regarding waste materials at commercial establishments, which would be placed in a metal, have to be placed in a metal or heavy-duty rigid plastic container. As far as violations and penalties, the same violations in the previous section we talked about with the boats and vehicles would apply. And then lastly, this would be subject to the clean hands.
This has its own clean hands.
So it's not on the list. Interesting. Dale, you don't have any problem with these clean hands, right?
There's no fine being assessed, Mr. Cole. What's the penalty?
Don't get nothing.
No, it says no county. If you got tall grass there, you can't get a building permit. You shouldn't like that, Dale.
That is with the penalties.
When do we ever find out about having tall grass?
Oh, so we're not going to enforce it. We're going to adopt this and not enforce it. I understand.
No, but tell me the first one we enforce, we find that.
Okay, Dale, that's all right.
Okay, that's fine, Mr. Cole. Let's go.
I got a question.
Yeah?
Sure. Page 5, it talks about, you know, the way we deliver the letter, the way they deliver the letter, personally deliver, send certified. Is there a drop-dead date? I mean, like time? Any word here, like, you know, we deliver the letter, gets back?
And nothing four above that, I think.
Is it, say, 60 days? 30 days? Within 30 days of a correction period?
Not less than 30 calendar days, but that could be extended if they had a plan to clean up or whatnot.
I understand. If somebody, you know, financially can't afford but's making an effort, we certainly don't want to drag them to court. Right. But within 30 days after they send a letter or get it back, is that, I guess.
It says that within the 30 days, the person shows an intent to correct the violation, then you can extend the time period to give them more time.
Okay, but I'm saying, but okay, they haven't done anything. Now we've sent a violation to them, which is a big issue right now. When that baby drops the, when we send the violation to them, I know the constable usually goes in X, Y, Z days, but we have a problem with the certification letters and all those types of things, getting, you know, if it gets to them, doesn't get to them, whatever.
You're going to post it on the property.
Okay, but then how long? You know, there's no, I don't see anywhere where it says, okay, it's got to be posted for 10 days, when we remember we're doing it.
Posting, the act of posting occurs when the notice is posted. Somebody could walk up as soon as the inspector leaves and rip it off, but it's still what
it is. I understand, but once we do it, there's no, it says it has to be, you know, after 10 days of posting the violation, then we can take them to court.
Or yeah, one day. I don't know that you'd want to require 10 days of posting because you're going to send an inspector back for 10 days straight to take a photograph to make sure.
No, I agree. I don't think, I mean, but I'm saying, I don't see where is the mechanism in there to say, okay, now we go to court.
So it would be whenever the county refers it to legal staff and says, issue a
kind of. Well, the legal staff doesn't go with the constable.
Well, let me correct that. Planning and zoning would issue the violation notice,
right,
turn it over to the constable. Right. The constable would then essentially go to JP Court.
But they usually go out and try also, if, I think in this procedure now, that if I'm not mistaken, I think the problem is that once it gets to that point and they try to, you know, get the person that lives in California this, that's when it starts becoming an issue with what we got. Is this going to correct that problem where, you know, they send a letter, they don't get any response, say it's a registered or a certified letter, comes back, that's all our obligation, we can go in and clean it up, and that we're done deal?
Or this is not obligation?
I mean, that we'll go to court, automatically go to
if the planning and zoning office issues a violation notice and turns it over to the constable, they could go to court.
Okay. In other words, they don't even have to go out. In other words, if it's a violation, they don't even have to go out, they can go right to court.
Somebody's going to bring it. You're probably talking about a complaint-driven policy.
Oh, absolutely.
Somebody's got to bring it to planning and zoning's attention.
Right.
And it probably would be either a zoning inspector or a constable that would bring it to zoning's attention.
So if nothing, if the property owner didn't take any action, we would have to wait at least 30 days from when
we should have had adequate time.
We sent the letter.
It's terrible.
Before the county could take action.
Bring it to
take them to court. Is that right?
Yes.
Okay.
That's correct.
Now that's on the vehicles and the boats.
Right.
The grass and all those kind of things.
It would apply to all those things.
But on the grass, we have a 10-day.
Okay. We can change some of those numbers later on.
You can change anything about this you want.
On this one, once we introduce it,
after the public hearing?
Okay, a number of days and different things, we can do some things. Okay. I got one other thing. You want to go ahead, Mr. Rogers?
I just think we ought to have the staff come up here, Alan, to make sure that what we're discussing.
Have you read this out on the other?
We're just good.
What are we doing at the public hearing? I mean, we're running an hour behind now. We're so far behind schedule.
We need to get his comments on this, though, because...
Well, then let's just defer this one and then just start it up again next week.
No, let's get his comments.
Because I want to make some comments.
You've had a hard time out there trying to enforce everything with the structure we got, and this needs to bring it in line. So what's your opinion about what's used before you?
Yeah, as far as like the grass and the trash going to P&Z, which is okay, but then they go ahead and patch it on down to us. As far as the other, P&Z handles that, and as far as the way that's being handled by this new ordinance, is fine.
Anything needs to be added that you see that's not being covered in this ordinance?
We've run every version of this passed out.
Okay. He's been cutting grass for 2 months.
Huh? Yeah.
I think it was a stand right now. I think we're in pretty good shape if anybody else has an account.
I think what you're saying is that this probably gives you more tools than you had now.
Oh, there's no doubt. Absolutely. Sure. This is what we've needed, yes.
But from what I'm understanding, as soon as Shane gets done, they give you the thing and you go to court.
Yeah. That's on the zoning issues as they stand right now. And on the grass and the trash, if any calls come in, you know, complaints come in with that, they should patch that down to us, and then we'll handle that part of it.
Mr. Cole?
Yeah, I just, on the page 4, on the vehicles and things of this nature, where number B, I'm still thinking that no more than 2 vehicles or 2 boats or other watercraft are either inoperable, dismantled, wrecked, et cetera, we're going to permit that.
Right.
That will be permitted. I think that's still excessive. In these residential areas, I mean, people could potentially have 2 cars or 2 trucks, 2 boats, have 4 wrecked, junked vehicles. Yeah. And when you read what this says, that they've been expired, they don't have current registration stickers, their components have been removed. I mean, some of these never leave. I don't know why we're being so generous with permitting the junk, the real junk, and we're even actually describing how bad it can be to just to exist in these residential areas. Well, why are we doing this?
After a public hearing, if you had a concern about that and you want it to be a total of 2, possibly 2.
I'd like to have 0.
Okay, well,
I don't know why anybody needs to
make that modification after the public hearing.
Okay, we could reduce that. That's what my question would be, because when you read that, I mean, there's no reason why any of this stuff should be on anybody's residential lots.
Well, it's there now.
It is there now, I know. But if this, we had this, we could get rid of this. This is part of the problem. Number B, read it.
Two boats and
orders, because you're placed
so it's all be 2 or either.
I think the reason...
I mean, the whole place.
I
I think the reason there's
a whole operation. Excuse me.
Yeah, sure.
You shouldn't be.
Mr. Cole? I think the reason too is they're trying to answer your question, Mr. Cole, was sometimes people do have antique vehicles that are not tagged, but they're restoring.
We have an exemption for that, Dale.
Okay.
That's in here. What B describes, I don't think covers what you're saying. I agree with you there, 100%.
Okay.
We have that antique vehicle thing.
It should be two boats or two.
Or zero or something less. Okay. This is excessive.
This is still excessive.
Two total.
This is excessive, yes. Two total, yes.
Okay.
That's what it says. No more than two boats and or.
Oh, right. That's what it
says.
It's four, Dale.
That would allow four, Dale. But you can cut that down. When you're drafting an ordinance,
I'd be glad to. I think the people in my district would appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Next time when we go,
Mr. Holloway, you would like to see that to say total of two cars, boats, whatever.
Total. Not his decision. Just two. Yes.
That's what it says, but they're saying it says four. So how they get four?
We can make that change before it's introduced.
Okay. Be two total.
Yes.
Zero.
I can choose what you want. Okay, thank you.
Zero.
One thing you might want to take note of, there's no phased-in implementation of this.
We probably have to lay off. I don't see what
Okay.
Okay.
Thank you.
Hit the road.
Would you like us to bring this back for discussion?
No. We have discussed this for 20 years. I think it's time we move on.
Okay. Bring it back for introduction. Let's go with it.
Would you like any changes at this
point? Yes. Say total. Any objections?
We can reduce it, Dale. We can reduce it.
Reduce it to public hearing.
Right.
Okay.
We don't have to make any change.
Okay. Okay. Come on, you're behind.
There's only one item, and that's just announcing that next Tuesday and Wednesday public meetings will be held on September 25th and 26th. September 25th from 6:30 to 8:30 at Rehoboth Bay Convention Center, or Rehoboth Beach Convention Center, and September 26th, the Royal Fire Company regarding the land use plan update, and a consultant will be there in the Portage County State.
If you recall, back in April, we renewed our group hospital insurance policy, and in that time, the council had some discussion or concerns about the overall cost of our group hospital. And perhaps maybe there was something we could do to reduce the cost while at the same time ensuring our employees had adequate coverage. This is over a $7 million expense to our budget. At the council's suggestion, we included funds in the fiscal year 2008 budget to have an objective consultant come in and take a look at various aspects of our group hospital plan to include a review of benefits, see if we can control the growth within the plan, maintain a competitive benefits program for our employees, and reduce or control our costs. Here today with us is Mr. Steve Fallon from Insurance Buyers Council. IBC is an independent consulting firm specializing in managing costs, risk, and administration. They handle property insurance, liability insurance, and employee benefit insurance. For more than 20 years, the county has used IBC as our insurance consultant. We use this firm to bid our insurance, review our insurance language in our contracts and leases, and offer insurance advice as needed. They do not sell us insurance, but make recommendations to help or advise, and they receive no commissions from insurance companies. The consultant fee for this would be a maximum of $25,725, of which their funds budgeted. And I'd like to introduce Mr. Fallon. He'd like to talk a little bit about what he would like to do.
Thanks, sir. Thanks for your time today. We handed out a copy of a PowerPoint presentation which summarized our full proposal for the county. I'd like to just direct your attention to page 12. The first two sections really just provide some background on our firm, Insurance Buyers Council. As Sue said, we are independent benefit consultants. So we do not receive any commissions from any insurance carriers for the placement of coverage. Page 12 really just sort of outlines, based on conversations with the county, what we understand your objectives to be, and that is to conduct a comprehensive review of your benefit programs, including the cost, the benefit levels, levels of service, funding methods, and provider discounts. To then work with you to develop a strategy to control the growth and employee benefit cost, and lastly, to maintain a competitive benefits program allowing the county to attract and retain talent and maintain a high level of employee satisfaction, which is our understanding you currently have with your benefit program. Pages 13 and 14 really just provide a little detail of how we would propose to go about reaching those objectives. And do we need to kind of go through what those are, or I can answer questions?
Are there any questions or concerns? This was a concern you had at the budget, so.
We've already hired him?
Well, I put funds in the budget.
Oh, okay.
I'm going to have a motion if you can.
It's 50% there. Oh, okay, I follow. My only question is, as you
know. Insurance Buyers Council is our, we use them for other things. It's a natural fit with their company and us, but no one's hired to do this until I can get the motion.
Okay. My only concern is you've talked about our generous program we have currently, and with things changing out there in the world, we have a Cadillac of a program, and I've always said maybe we ought to cut it off and let those current employees keep that Cadillac, but then the new employees might have to have a Buick or something else, you know, a nice package, but maybe not quite as generous, and still be able to retain, like you said earlier, you know, and attract good employees. So when you look at that's possible, is that in your realm of things to look at?
I mean, it includes, our evaluation is going to include everything from sort of what we would consider low-hanging fruit, which are sort of common sense things that you could do to affect the administrative expense items, and then focus on sort of longer-term, bigger ticket items to actually affect the true cost, the claim cost, which drive 80%.
Well, it's a fast-growing county, and our county government's growing, mm-hmm. and that means just more and more expense, and I'm just wondering, you know, in the future, should we continue offering what we've been offering, which has been awfully generous?
And I think, I mean, ultimately, that's going to be a decision left to you, but I will tell you that traditionally, government has provided Cadillac benefit plans, and you know, with given the increase in cost, have made the decision that there needs to be some cutback, and yet remain, in most cases, well above what the private sector is providing for their employees. So I definitely think there's some common ground to be able to reduce your cost, and yet provide people with benefits that would be unparalleled in, you know, in the rest of the county.
So in other words, that could be part of a report from you back
yes.
to us on that.
Okay.
And recommendation. Thank you.
Have a motion.
Any other questions?
Yes.
No?
Yeah, motion.
Susie?
I do. Be it moved that the Sussex County Council authorizes the firm of IBC to perform a review of our group hospital benefits at a maximum fee of $25,725.
So it could be less?
It could be.
Depends how fast it works.
I want to get that on tape.
You guarantee that you're going to save
that much money? Because we don't pay much.
We cannot guarantee that we're going to save you that much money. I will tell you that most of the time we're successful in exceeding our fee in terms of recommendations. But you know, to guarantee that would be to.
It wouldn't take much, say $25,000, that's for sure.
Not on an over $7 million. Spending
on recommendation. On the finance director, I make that motion.
Second.
I have a motion, Mr. Rogers, second, Mr. Jones, to approve the motion. Just read by Susan Webb. Any questions?
Oh, does he want to review our pay scale, too, Susan?
No.
No, she's not.
I didn't know.
Mr. Cole?
Yes.
Mr. Phillips?
Yes.
Mr. Rogers?
Yes.
Mr. Jones?
Yes.
Yes, motion's carried.
Thank you.
Thank you, Steve, for coming down. Next, I have a resolution. I'll briefly go over this. This is a resolution in a public hearing approving a written agreement for firefighting services with Indian River Volunteer Fire Company and the issuance of certain bonds by Indian River Volunteer Fire Company. The Indian River Volunteer Fire Company proposes to issue up to $450,000 of bonds of the Indian River Fire Company to fund the acquisition of a new pumper fire truck for the fire company. The intent of the fire company is that the interest on its bonds qualify for exclusion from gross income of the owners for federal tax purposes. Interest on the bonds will not qualify for exclusion for tax purposes unless the issuance of the bonds is approved by the elected representative of the governmental unit with which the Indian River Fire Company has entered into an agreement. After a public hearing to consider the issuance of the bonds that has been conducted by such government following reasonable notice that the Indian River Fire Company will continue to provide volunteer firefighting services within the county. The Indian River Fire Company will enter into a written agreement with the county to confirm fire services to the area. The Sussex County Council will qualify the interest payable on the county bonds for exclusion from gross income for federal tax purposes and approve the issuance of the bonds of the Indian River Fire Company in a maximum aggregate principal amount not to exceed $450,000 for the purpose of financing a portion of the costs of the project, provided that the bonds shall not be an obligation of the Indian River Fire Company and shall never be a debt of the county, and the county shall not be liable for any payment on the bonds and is not pledging its credit as security for the bonds or notes to be issued by the company. And here today is Mr. Hal Salmons, bond counsel for Indian River Fire Company, and I believe it representative from Indian River Fire Company.
Before you gentlemen start, I'd like to announce that this is a public hearing, as indicated by Mrs. Webb. We'll start the public hearing by having Mr. Salmons give some background as to the project and what's being accomplished by the project. And after he and anyone else who has spoken in favor of this have completed their presentations, we will give an opportunity for any member of the public who would like to come forward and express a concern, raise a question, to do so. So that it's truly a public hearing. Mr. Salmons, would you give us a background and refer to the advertising?
Certainly. Good morning. My name is Hal Salmons. I'm from Potter Anderson and Caroon in Wilmington. I serve as the county's bond counsel, but I'm here today at the request of the Indian River Volunteer Fire Company and Wilmington Savings Fund Society in connection with a loan from WSFS to the Volunteer Fire Company for the purchase of a new fire truck. This process is before county today because essentially back in 1986 Congress changed the tax laws and requires a governmental entity to assist volunteer fire companies in their own borrowings to get a favorable tax exempt rate. So in essence, what the Volunteer Fire Company and the bank are requesting the county to do today is to consider this resolution after this opportunity for everybody to be heard and favorably conclude and agree that the Volunteer Fire Company can issue its own debt to buy this fire truck. By assisting the Volunteer Fire Company today, you'll enable the Volunteer Fire Company to borrow money at a lower rate of interest, which will save the Volunteer Fire Company money. This is not debt of the county. This is not guaranteed by the county. Other than this approval process, the county is not at all involved. This will be a direct loan from the bank to the Volunteer Fire Company, and the Volunteer Fire Company will give the bank whatever security the bank requires. So all you're doing is assisting the Volunteer Fire Company and really giving the opportunity to have a public hearing. In Delaware, as you all know, there's the State Fire Prevention Commission, which was created back in the 70s and 80s to really regulate volunteer fire company jurisdictional issues. Prior to that time, volunteer fire companies had written agreements with the counties and with the municipalities, and that established the exclusive firefighting jurisdictions of volunteer fire companies. That model was used in New York. Senator D'Amato adopted that model back in the tax law changes in the 1980s, and that's why today we have a requirement that a governmental entity with which the volunteer fire company has a written agreement must approve of one of these deals to make it tax exempt. Here in Delaware, the written agreement that the tax code talks about is somewhat superfluous anymore because the State Fire Prevention Commission regulates the volunteer fire companies. However, the State Volunteer Fire Prevention Commission is not a, quote, political subdivision under the tax code. So the State Volunteer Fire Prevention Commission does not entertain these types of requests and hearings because back in the 90s it decided it didn't want to be considered to be a political subdivision, and so the volunteer fire companies were between a rock and a hard place. The State Fire Prevention Commission regulates their jurisdictional areas, and they're not a political subdivision and wouldn't hold a hearing. So since the very early 1990s, the volunteer fire companies have been coming to all three counties, most of the municipalities, including to this county, requesting for assistance in these types of transactions. So before you today is a resolution that will do two things. It will approve a written agreement with the volunteer fire company that establishes that the volunteer fire company has exclusive volunteer firefighting service responsibilities in its jurisdiction. And that written agreement before a council specifies that that jurisdiction is established, regulated, and will change with state law. So you're not expanding or doing anything other than agreeing to what's in place. But by entering into a written agreement and acknowledging that, you're enabling the volunteer fire company to get a lower interest rate on its borrowings. And I think there's some gentlemen here from Indian River, and I'd ask you to come up and introduce yourself and explain to council exactly what you're borrowing for. Anybody have any questions on that?
If you've already said this, I apologize. Why haven't we done this for other volunteers?
Yeah, you've done this for Georgetown, Ellendale, three or four of them in the past. The exact same process.
I believe this is the least amount I've ever asked for, isn't it?
Yeah, I think it might be. Although it's a truck.
It's a vehicle to get here.
It's exactly right. You're assisting me.
Yeah, but for me,
the least amount I've ever asked for.
Right.
Yeah.
Could you gentlemen, before you make your statement, just give us your name and address, please?
Yes. My name is Ronan Walker. I live at 30 Apache Avenue, World Park, Millsboro, Pennsylvania. I'm old Pennsylvanian, so it still sticks with me. The reason we're here today, we're trying to save money as much as we can. As everybody in this council knows, we have been swamped with buildings in the last 3 years. And believe me, we're trying to catch up. And we're trying to save every penny we can possibly save. And we appreciate you guys hearing us today. And we don't know what the future holds for us. We know we'll have to make more expansion on your station, too, somewhere down the road, probably in the next 3 years, just to catch up. So whatever we can save, we appreciate it.
Could you explain a little bit about the pumper truck you're buying?
Yes, we had it. The guys were up there yesterday. And this new pumper, it's 1,200 gallons of water, which is going to help us out tremendously, although we are getting more and more fire hydrants in our area, which we haven't had very good fortune with. We are putting bigger means in for better water supply. But this will help us maintain our fire service. It's class one, and we hope we can still maintain it through the future. Thank you.
Dominic Messina, 2849 Chippewa Avenue, Millsboro, Delaware. Basically what Roland said.
You're right behind.
I don't want to take your time up.
Thank you.
Good speech.
You got a motion?
This is a time period for anybody else who may have any comments pro or con. Does anybody want to come up and address the county's assistance for the volunteer fire company?
Any member of the public have an interest in this matter? Let the record show everyone else has to be.
Excuse me, I'm going to add something also. We don't have a city or a town to help us out with our monies, and we try to do the best we can with what we do have. We're doing extensive remodeling for kitchen at Station 1. There's starter breakfasts and stuff, so we're trying to do the best we can. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions that I could address for council?
Nope.
Close it, read it, Mr. Griffin.
We will close it. Let me ask one more time. Does anyone here from the public who wants to be heard? Let the record show no one else has to be recognized. We will close the public hearing. And do you have a motion?
Yes.
Could you read that, please?
Be it moved that the Sussex County Council approve the resolution approving a written agreement for firefighting services with Indian River Volunteer Fire Company and the issuance of certain bonds by Indian River Volunteer Fire Company.
So moved. Second. Motion, Mr. Cole. Second, Mr. Phillips, to approve the motion. Read the rest. Susan Webb, any questions?
Mr. Cole?
Yes.
Mr. Phillips?
Yes.
Mr. Rogers?
Yes.
Mr. Jones?
Yes.
Yes, motion's carried.
Thank you.
Mr. Godwin, do you call? Thanks, Al.
Thank you.
Mr. President, members of council, this morning we have one wastewater agreement for your consideration, and that is Sussex County Project Number 81-04, the Woodlands of Pepper Creek, Agreement Number 666.
Oh, 666.
The develop